Good morning. Our first case this morning is the United States against Oliver. Counsel for defense, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I am Captain Tiffany Duell, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Jonathan Potter, we represent the appellant specials Mervyn W. Oliver Jr. in this matter. Now, the evidence is legally insufficient to the offense of desertion, where the government's only evidence at trial to prove appellant possessed the necessary intent to remain away from his unit permanently was the length of appellant's absence. Under the precedent of this court, as stated in United States v. Kerr, extraordinary duration of absence, standing alone, will not establish the intent required for a finding of desertion. And the government did not meet this burden where there was no circumstantial evidence presented beyond the duration of the absence from which to draw the necessary intent. Contrary to the government's argument, there was insufficient evidence to show appellant had sought or obtained civilian employment.
Well, wasn't there other evidence? It may not have been overwhelming evidence, but I mean, he did leave his belongings in storage and made no attempt to get those back. There was at least some evidence that he was going to this pizzeria in Brooklyn, and I don't know if you can determine whether or not he was working there, but he was supporting his daughter.
Yes, Your Honor. Regarding the pizzeria, the government called appellant's sister to try to show the appellant was employed. However, as the sister testified, she wasn't certain. She couldn't say for sure whether or not the appellant was employed. She said she dropped him off at a pizzeria. However, she didn't say specifically how many times she had done it, what he was wearing, whether she had ever saw him, with money, or whether or not he was actually supporting his daughter.
Well, didn't he? He wasn't getting paid. The Army wasn't paying him. Okay. 3 years went by. He had to be living on something.
He was, as the sister testified, he was living with his mother in the house that he lived at for his entire life. And the government could have shown or sought evidence that he was actually employed, either W-2s or someone from the pizzeria, if he was actually working there, to come in and testify to show employment. However, the government didn't do that in this case.
Okay. The standard, this is illegal. The issue, of course, is not what we would do if we were the judge or we were the members. It's a legal sufficiency case.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you know what standard for legal sufficiency is. So how can you argue that this isn't legal, that no rational trier of fact would find this, that he had the requisite intent?
Under the evidence presented at trial, the government was able to present was a mere modicum under Jackson versus Virginia. It was some evidence which was relevant to the intent. However, a modicum of evidence the modicum of evidence would not by itself rationally support a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So while it was some evidence, and it was
well, but that now you're shading over to factual sufficiency. You're talking about. You seem to be shading over to factual sufficiency. I know the line's fuzzy,
yes, Your Honor. But
let's try and stay with legal.
Yes, Your Honor. So a rational trier of fact could not have found the element that the accused intended to remain away permanently when the evidence that the government presented was the duration of the offense, the testimony from the sister that she wasn't sure whether or not he was employed.
I'm interrupting you. Can you hold your place there for a moment? But you say a rational member could not infer an intent to stay away from 17 years to pick a random number?
Yes, Your Honor. As this court stated in Coker, an absence of 17 days or 17 months or 17 years is only an absence. And though its probative value may be great.
Right, it doesn't prove intent in its own right, but why can't, using the Jackson standard, why can't it be used to infer an intent?
It can when viewed in concert with other circumstances.
No, I think that you're misreading the Cothern case. I mean, in that case, the problem was that the members were instructed that the intent was established by the length of absence.
Yes, Your
Honor. So there was a presumption. It didn't say that the length of absence alone, that they can't infer intent from that, but the problem in that case was the instruction basically said that was it.
Well,
X equal Y.
As this court later stated in Kerr, in citing Cothern, Kerr stated that the extraordinary duration by itself was not evidence of intent. And so it logically, I think it comes down to the same result by, you know, erroneous instructing the panel that they can't infer just from that duration versus if the government only shows the duration of the absence. And part of that is that absences of different lengths may vary in their significance according to the times, the conditions, and circumstances under which they take place, such that, you know, a two-day absence that's terminated by apprehension where the unit is about to deploy and the accused has made statements that he doesn't want to be part of the mission would be evident of an intent to remain away permanently. However, a 10-year absence where the accused is stranded on a deserted island or is imprisoned would not have the same, not show that same intent. Turning to the earlier question regarding the property, the property was put in storage prior to appellants going on leave. He was PCSing from Redstone Arsenal to Fort Eustace. As he testified, he put his belongings, his house group belongings, in storage. That was prior to his going on leave and prior to his the initiation of his absence.
Well, which way does that cut? Doesn't the fact that he arguably abandoned it argue in favor of an intent to remain away permanently?
If the absence had been terminated by apprehension, then the inference would be that he abandoned it. But in this case, the appellant surrendered voluntarily to Fort Hamilton back to military authority. And that's the most compelling evidence here, is that if anything, that shows his intent to return. And the government didn't put any evidence to rebut that inference of that his intent was only to remain away temporarily, not permanently. And so circumstances which give the duration of the absence context from which a rational trier of fact can draw those reasonable inferences.
So you don't think that the trier of fact could have found that his statement that it took him 33 months to get his daughter settled was incredible? You don't think that they could have taken his statement and disbelieved it?
Why not? They could. I mean,
because I mean, under the scenario that you're describing, so long as someone takes a stand and comes up with some reason, and as long as at some point they turn themselves in, you can never, no rational trier of fact could ever find that they had an intent to remain away permanently sometime during 33 months, 60 months, 10 years.
If there was no other evidence presented by the government, if it's just the duration, and to answer your question, Your Honor,
it's not just the duration. I mean, there's the fact that he didn't turn himself in at an earlier point in time. It's not like there was no opportunity to do that. And he did testify, and they could have easily disbelieved him.
They could have disbelieved him, Your Honor. What they could not have done, however, is from that infer an intent to remain away permanently. I think that when he's saying that I only intended to remain away temporarily, under the legal sufficiency standard, they could, you know, drawing a inference or drawing the evidence in light most favorable to the government, they could have completely disbelieved him. But then you're still left with what did the government prove during their case in chief, the duration of the absence, and that he surrendered voluntarily. And this was a service member with 10 years of good service who turn himself in voluntarily to military authorities.
Counsel, does CARE stand for the proposition that the members of the panel cannot infer intent to remain away permanently from length, or does it stand for the proposition that they can't then apply that inference as the sole basis for the conviction?
The latter, Your Honor, that it alone will not establish.
So, in other words, it does permit the inference. The length does permit an inference.
Yes, Your
in
Honor.
This case. And would you go through the argument that the government made at trial and address the points that the government made at trial in addition to length and as to whether they would meet the Jackson against Virginia standard?
Yes, Your Honor. Just looking at the government's closing argument, starting at Joint Appendix 37, they brought out that Mrs. Oliver testified, that's his sister, that she didn't know the circumstances surrounding his brother's absence from the Army. She could not confirm whether or not he may have been employed. But, you know, simply from the circumstantial evidence, you must consider all the relevant facts and circumstances, particularly the duration of the absence. The length of the absence is circumstantial evidence that his sister never saw his military property in possession, and that the accused surrendered a considerable distance from his duty station. Regarding that last point, the accused, as stated in the stipulation of fact, the accused was, or the appellant was on leave in between his two duty stations. So the fact that he surrendered a considerable distance from the duty stations isn't probative in this case, because the initiation of the of his absence wasn't from duty station at Redstone or the duty station at Fort Eustis. It was initiated while he was on leave. Secondly, I think a lot of the times have changed from 50 years ago, from when a lot of these cases on desertion took place, and it's a lot easier to fly and to travel and to get from one place to another. But the argument that the government made was mainly the duration of the absence.
What is it about the relationship between Brooklyn and Fort Eustis and Redstone that's different now as opposed to the time that Kerr was tried?
The distances are the same. However, it's given all the advances of travel, it's much easier to get from one place to another.
And how does that relate to Jackson against Virginia in this case?
Well, you're addressing the manual point about location being indicative of an attempt to stay away, right? So
if
you're on the moon, it would be somewhat apparent that you're not coming back.
Yes, Your Honor.
But your point is, if you can hop a plane in 3 minutes, it doesn't necessarily indicate that you're planning to stay away, right?
Yes, Your Honor. As opposed to 60 years ago, if you got on a train and traveled 3,000 miles away, that would be more evident of the intent back in 1950 than being in Brooklyn in 2009.
What's your worst fact other than the duration from which the members might have inferred something?
Probably the appellant's own testimony. You could have completely disbelieved everything that he said. I think the appellant's own testimony.
What about the sister's statement that she thought his service was over? Isn't that indicative that he's carrying himself like someone who's done?
Yes, Your Honor. She disbelieved the service was finished because if he was home, then after 10 years and he was home. But the trial counsel never elicited what he was wearing, what he was doing, what he said. And in fact, when asked, did you ever have a conversation with him about it, she specifically said no. So while this is her opinion and belief, there's nothing in there to indicate what the appellant's state of mind was, as opposed to her own state of mind, just based on the fact that he was home.
Well, it would be some indication, at least, that he didn't talk to his sister about his desire to return, if she thought his service was over.
Possibly. Any further questions from the court, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
You'll have that opportunity. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, members of the court, may it please the court. I'm Captain Ken Bornito, and along with my co-counsel, Major Sarah Root, represent the government as appellee in this case. The government presented sufficient evidence at trial for a rational trier of fact to find that appellant intended to remain away permanently in violation of Article 85 of CMJ. In accordance with the principles set forth in U.S. v. Cawthorn, the government also presented sufficient additional evidence beyond the length of the appellant's absence to support the panel's finding beyond reasonable doubt. As discussed in the government's brief, there was evidence of at least four additional factors present in this case.
This case has an amazing number of loose ends and unexplored tunnels. he's on the stand. He says, well, it took 33 months to get my kid in order. Well, you know, there's no follow-up. There's no nothing. Well, I dropped him off at a pizzeria. Boop. There's nothing. What are we to make of this unexplored maze?
Yes, Your Honor, obviously it's not a model of trial advocacy and questioning and bringing up some of those finer points. But what I believe it does show is that these are issues that are left open for the panel in deciding this case to question.
Well, we left up, I mean, if you just say he's guilty, panel, it's up to you. I don't think that's enough. What are you arguing?
Well, not in that case, Your Honor.
Are you arguing that there was an effort to infer under Jackson?
Yes, Your Honor. There's enough to infer from the comments and the testimony from the witnesses and the evidence in the case through the stipulation of fact and such to infer these finer points in regard to these factors regarding an intent to remain away permanently. Turning to some of those, beyond just the length of absence, which is, as has been noted, can its probative effect can be very high, as noted in U.S. v. Cockle. The only requirement is that it cannot be the only thing relied upon to infer an intent to remain away permanently. So we must look to additional factors to determine whether or not sufficient evidence was presented to find that the accused intended to remain away permanently. And the first question really is, based on that ruling, how much additional evidence is required to find an intent to remain away permanently? And the government would submit that the proper way of analyzing that is using a sliding scale, in that the longer the absence, the less additional evidence is actually required to show an intent to remain away permanently. In that if someone was gone for a week, you would likely need a lot more evidence to prove that they were intending to remain away permanently, whereas if someone was gone for upwards of 30 years, the evidence to show an intent to remain away permanently is probably less. Turning now to the points in this case and the factors that the government discussed, the first would be that appellant abandoned his uniforms and equipment when he placed it in storage and left it in storage without ever checking on it at any time during his three-year absence. Obviously, this is a fact that can cut both ways. As the MCM points out, the fact that if you leave your uniforms or equipment in with the unit or on a ship, obviously the ship doesn't apply here, so the question is whether or not this would constitute a unit in terms of the MCM. I believe that this factor would cut both ways. It would favor both the appellant and the government, but under a legal sufficiency standard, taking all evidence in the light most favorable to the government, a rational panel could look at this factor and infer from that an intent to remain away permanently, or use that in cumulative with the remaining evidence in the case to find an intent to remain away permanently. The second point would be that appellant surrendered a considerable distance from his duty station. Appellant was assigned to Fort Eustis, Virginia, where he was required to report. He is surrendered at Fort Hamilton, New York, which is located in Brooklyn, New York. Now, there's no evidence in the record about exactly how far away Fort Eustis is from Fort Hamilton. Trial counsel and both...
Does that really support your position?
Say again, Your
Honor? Does that really support your position? That's one of those same facts that heads you, I win, tails you, lose, right? So... Maybe he was just so anxious to get back, he couldn't control his excitement, and he needed to go in, or more likely, he wanted somebody else to pay for the ticket.
It's possible, Your Honor, and that could factor in that manner. But it's also just a principle laid out by the MCM that this is something to consider, that he's required to report to a specific location. The fact that he is located somewhere far away from that location means that he may not have intended to return at that point.
Well, what do we make of the fact that he did surrender voluntarily? This was not terminated by apprehension.
Well, as this Court's noted before, voluntary return is not dispositive of the issue.
Length isn't dispositive. Voluntary return isn't dispositive.
Right, Your Honor. The reason for that is because desertion is an instantaneous offense, in that you need only obtain that intent to remain away permanently at some moment in time while you are absent. Once you obtain that intent to remain away permanently, even if you later recant that and decide that, well, I'm going to turn myself in and come back, that doesn't really matter because you've already committed the offense.
Moving on to counsel, why don't we apply this inference in this case? In a case in which the government was able to obtain only a BCD in 6 months confinement, fairly typical sentence in an AWOL case of this length, that the government didn't have any other evidence in this case, that the absence of a cross-examination, the absence of even the slightest inquiry to a potential employer at the place where he was located, no follow-up on any of these matters would indicate that there was no evidence that the government had. Why don't we apply that inference here?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, it's not that there was no evidence or that there was very little evidence. The primary factor, and the government acknowledges that the primary factor in this case is the length of absence, a three-year absence, which clearly indicates, or could clearly indicate to a rational trier of fact, an intent to remain away permanently. And so the question really is, taken in consideration the decision in Cawthorn as applied by CARE, is whether or not there was sufficient additional evidence for a panel to make that inference. And so in this case, the point is bringing up these additional factors which were present, which a panel could have relied upon in addition to that.
But my question is, when we look at the record as a whole and we're trying to determine what a rational panel could decide, why don't we look at the record as a whole in terms of what inferences can be drawn from what was not asked and what was not pursued by the government, where there are obvious alleys to pursue there?
Yes, sir. And that is legitimate to look into, to consider the fact that a panel may have seen that the government didn't present any other evidence. They didn't definitively prove that he worked at a pizzeria. They didn't go into all this. And the panel could have considered that in looking at that. But the question really is whether any rational trier of fact could have found the elements of desertion met in this case. And so under that standard, looking at the record as a whole, there are sufficient points for any panel to have relied upon in this case to have found as they did here.
Counsel, what is the rationale for the manual provision that takes into account the distance between the duty station and where the individual turned himself in or was apprehended? I mean, I know your answer would be, why are you arguing that? Your answer would be, it's in the manual. Well, what's the rationale to put it in the manual?
My understanding of that rationale is the fact that if you take someone who's supposed to be in location A and they end up residing someplace 5,000 miles away, where they eventually turn themselves in that 5,000 miles away, that considerable geographical distance may indicate an intent not to return in the fact that if you're close by your post or your duty station, you may have been gone for some reason, doing something or other, you were just away where you couldn't come back or something like that.
But as the discussion touched on earlier, in this day and age, you're hours away almost from any place in the United States from your duty station. And if it's the length that is involved, I just don't see how that is an important criteria anymore. Going to intent. I mean, you certainly can be 15 minutes away and have an intent not to return. But in your argument, the fact that you were 15 minutes away wouldn't be a presumption of intent to remain away permanently.
Right, yeah, and that is true that times have changed, and obviously things are different than they were 50 years ago, and that factor probably weighs slightly differently in respect to the fact that it's much easier to travel. If you are located on one side of the country, it's much easier to get to the other side of the country now than it was 50 years ago, so it may not be as heavily of a factor. And that's kind of what the government's point is in this case, is that it's not the single factor alone which proves an intent to remain away permanently. We have to look at the cumulative nature of all the evidence, still taking into account the length of the appellant's absence in light of that absence, which can be highly probative of the fact of the intent to remain away permanently. The government's not saying that because he turned himself in at Fort Hamilton as a port of Eustis, that proves definitively that he intended to remain permanently. The government's position is that was one factor that the panel could have relied upon in also justifying its inference from the length of absence that the intended to remain away permanently.
The government's arguing that sometime after 11 September and sometime before 15 July, he established the intent?
Correct, sir.
Because he clearly didn't have the intent on 15 July when he surrendered, right?
Likely not, Your Honor, yes, obviously. In terms of him.
You're not arguing that when he left on leave or whatever, he had the intent then, are you?
Well, I don't know about that point, Your Honor. There's nothing really in the record to indicate the exact...
He sends his uniforms and all his stuff to the next base. It's sort of an odd thing to do if you're planning to leave. And he re-enlisted the month before.
Potentially, Your Honor.
Okay. So when, during that time period, did he establish the intent to stay away permanently?
The government can't point to a specific moment in time where the appellant intended or established that specific intent. The nature of the case is just the fact that based on the circumstances and the inferences drawn from those circumstances, that at some point he did create that intent.
So at some point he did, and then at some point he turned it off.
Correct, sir.
How much leave did he have?
Was
that in a record?
I don't know that on top of my head, Your Honor. Turning to the third point, that he could have conveniently surrendered in this case. Appellant resided in Brooklyn, New York, and Fort Hamilton was located in Brooklyn, New York. So that point being that he could have at any time very easily turned himself in, as he eventually did in 15 July 2006, being so close to the military post there, is a factor that the panel could have considered in addition to the others. The final factor was, of course, appellant made preparations indicative of an intent not to return. This would be the fact that appellant may or may not have had a job during his time away at potentially a pizzeria. Now, obviously, the evidence in this case with regards to that fact is not direct. There's no clear-cut straight answer from the witness, appellant's sister, that yes, he had a job and yes, he worked at a pizzeria. What I believe is clear from the record, however, is that appellant's sister's credibility was greatly called into question. In light of some of the questions that were asked by the trial counsel, do you recall speaking to me yesterday? And there's the tenor and the nature of the answers that she was given. And while this court's not supposed to decide issues of credibility, this court could at least look to the fact that there was an issue of credibility based not just on the fact that she was appellant's sister and had an interest in the case and a bias, but also on the nature of her answers to her questions.
Wait, you're saying she's not credible?
Well, in light of the way that she brings forward her
so she's not credible, so that don't you need her for the pizzeria and all the other stuff?
Well, just in the nature of the fact, Your Honor, that she didn't specifically say, yes, he worked at a pizzeria. Yes, I recall telling you yesterday that I told you that he worked at a pizzeria.
Without the sister, you're back to duration.
Well, Your Honor, it's not that she's not credible at all. It's that she's not
giving you... She's credible on the points that help you, but not on the ones that don't. I get it.
Obviously, yeah.
That kind of witness.
The point with this witness is the fact that she was not giving direct answers. There's no direct point where she says either yes or no that he worked at a pizzeria. It's very ambiguous. She says, I would like to say that he was, but I cannot say for certain that he was. I don't know, I'm not sure. Do you recall having a conversation with me on or about the 25th of November? Correct, yes, but I wasn't sure I could say that. Do you recall telling me that you believe he may have worked at a pizzeria in town? Maybe. The nature of the questions were essentially trying to dodge the questions being asked for the nature of her answers. In that respect, all the government's asking this court to do is recognize that a panel could have seen her testimony and taken from her testimony that she was not willing to give up evidence against her brother at that point on the stand. And a panel could have inferred from her testimony that Helen did, in fact, have employment, whether at a pizzeria or someplace else. In addition to the other points that this court already raised about the fact that Appellant was gone for 3 years. His stated reason for being gone was to take care of his daughter. And so, and she noted, the sister noted, that he must have been supporting her some way. So the likelihood that he did have a job was something that the panel could have found from the evidence in this case. So when you take those four factors together, the cumulative nature of those factors, in addition to the lengthy absence that Appellant had of almost 3 years, a rational trier of fact could easily have found beyond reasonable doubt that Appellant intended to remain away permanently. For that reason, the government requests this honorable court affirm the findings of the sentence as approved. If there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
The government had the burden in this case to show the appellant had the requisite intent. And while the government's case need not be perfect, they still need to meet that, prove that element beyond a reasonable doubt. And in this case, the government failed where the record is devoid of any evidence of what the appellant was doing during that period of time, where he was, what he did, what he wore, what he said, what he didn't say. Evidence which, if produced, might have been competent legal evidence to prove an intent to remain away permanently, if it ever existed at all. For those reasons, we respectfully request this court to set aside the findings and the sentence.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until 5 minutes after 10 o'clock.
stands in recess until 10:05.